Welcome to week number 40. This is the podcast that we put together on the back end of our newsletter for Rexilom. You are now live with Kirby Lachrunji and Dawn Redler for Rexilom. Dawn, interesting week on the markets for the week. Both the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ actually ended up for the week, you know, kind of breaking this negative cycle. There's a S&P 500 resistance level of about 4,200 that lots of technical analysts are talking about at the moment. If it goes through that 4,200 and meaningfully breaks to the bottom, then you might see a lot more downside in this market. Alternatively, it might actually just bounce around at those kind of levels. FTSE 100 is down 1.5% for the week. The CACARA, which is from France, is down 1% for the week. And then if you go across into Asia, Nikkei 225 was down, 2.6% on the week. So mixed bag, really, really in markets. Commodities, Brent and crude, which we'll talk about just now, meaningfully broke lower for the week. Brent oil in the UK was down 11% and crude was down 8.8%. Given the Israeli tension and against Hamas, this might actually be changing quite dramatically, and we'll talk about that a little bit later on. US bonds, again, continue to break on the upside. US 10-year yield for the week, that's up 4.7%, and US 20-year yields is up 5.11%. Rand dollar, 1929. Not quite as bad as what I started seeing towards the latter part of last week, but 1929 is a meaningful number for those with capital overseas. So a real mixed bag as far as markets are concerned, Dawn. And it'll be interesting to see where all of this goes in the next week, the next month, the next 3 months, because a lot of this has got to do with the quantitative tightening happening at the same time as yields continuously pushing higher.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch. And, you know, as I say in the newsletter, you know, we seem to have been on this recession watch for months and months and months, and nothing seems to happen. And it's just sort of bumbling on, and we keep looking at the indices and, you know, trying to look for some direction in terms of where is this market going, especially, you know, sort of coming into the end of the year, because that nice little sort of lift that we saw at the end of last year, the beginning of this year, is going to be behind us from a statistical point of view very shortly. And so those numbers are on a year-on-year basis are not going to look quite as nice as they do right now. And, you know, when that happens, then sentiment usually changes. Not necessarily for people like you and I who understand the statistics and have been seeing this slowdown over a number of months, but for investors. And investors start getting nervous and they're saying, this is no longer a real return.
Dawn, I mean, it makes for interesting times, I think, in markets. We're going to be watching what happens. I think the Federal Reserve really is in a conundrum at the end of the day. And I write about that in this week's newsletter. I think, firstly, they're trying to pull back on liquidity. That's the first thing. So they're trying to tighten or quantitatively tighten. At the same time, they're rejigging the yield curve because a lot of their bonds that they have in issuance is busy coming up for renewal. And they got to figure out what they want to do with their yield curve. That's the second thing that's busy happening. And at the third thing that's happening, they've increased rates at an unprecedented level to try and match and meet inflation that has, quite frankly, now started cooling and continues to cool in the United States. Now the question is, what is the next answer for this? Now, generally speaking, if you look historically, the Federal Reserve likes to pause. So they pause at a certain level, and then there's almost like this mountaintop for rates where they don't change anything for a couple of months before they then get forced into a position where they have to drop rates. Now, remember, this is going hand in glove with the rejigging of the yield curve, and it's going hand in glove with the quantitative tightening agenda as well. You might find that we are literally just going to get to a point where they're going to have to release liquidity back into the market. A little bit of what we saw perhaps kind of towards the first quarter of this year, where we saw that Midwestern banking crisis in the United States. Remember, Credit Suisse was caught up in a lot of that, not for the same reasons, but just caught up and was then taken over by UBS. And that is a process that now continues. And you might find that the Federal Reserve is then forced, and they won't just be forced to drop rates. They're going to be forced to make liquidity available in the system. And they might not do both of them at the same time, depending on the kind of crisis that kind of plays itself out. So I've had to make, in the beginning of the year, the Worldwide Flexible Fund that we manage, I had a bond position on the portfolio. It was about circa 18% of the portfolio. That in June, I already had reduced down. And literally a couple of weeks ago, I went and I sold the complete bond exposure in the Worldwide Flex Fund in favor of cash. And the reason for that is just because it is just so murky as far as bonds are concerned. Nowhere has it really ever happened where bonds just have two consecutive years of negative results. And you might find that 2022 and 2023 are 2 years which is just going to be a complete outsider. So what happens in the bond markets from here? Dawn, your guess is as good as mine. I absolutely have no idea where bonds are going to go, and I don't know where terminal rates are as far as US long-dated bonds are concerned. And all of this is what has got markets scared at this stage.
Toby, bonds are very interesting, and you know they're also fairly poorly understood, especially for the man on the street who doesn't quite understand how they're priced. And it's a double-edged sword in that, yes, the capital value of existing bonds has to drop in order to accommodate the higher yields that you're getting. But it does mean for the first time in a very long time, anybody offshore seeking yield is going to be able to find them in bonds. And they, you know, I've seen them on Bloomberg and this kind of thing. There's a lot more talk about actually getting yield from bonds. And this is for the first time, probably in nearly two decades.
And this is, I think, the conundrum for emerging market countries, such as South Africa. Generally, in the past, it could buy a South African bond and get a very decent yield pickup over what you could earn in, say, US bonds or European bonds. And it was always those aren't risky, but the emerging market bonds are risky. So therefore, that's what explains the yield differential between the two. Well, that yield differential has broken down somewhat because in US bonds, you can now earn 5%. Call it 5%, but it's circa 5%. It's somewhere in that region. Whereas in South African bonds, you're earning more than that, obviously, but it doesn't necessarily reward you for the risk that you're assuming by placing your money in South African bonds. It also then brings in a second issue, and that is for those, and I'm talking about big governments now, for those that need to buy bonds en masse, there's a much bigger and a wider playing field than just the South African market or the emerging market bond space. Because suddenly you could go and buy US 30-year treasuries and get away with 4.5%. Or heck, put your money just in very short-dated treasuries and get 5%. Why bother taking the risk in South Africa? And this has a direct impact on the fiscus in South Africa. It's got a direct impact with the taxes we're going to pay and a direct impact into everything that's busy happening in the South African space at the moment.
And it the worst time possible, Kobe, just as they're trying to roll over and get more funds and this kind of thing, you know, sort of stuck with their head between a rock and a hard place, whereas offshore investors were looking at a sort of a sweetener almost of sort of 7-8%, and our bonds are just not there. They're nearer sort of, hey, we'll give you a sweetener, but it's only 4-5%. And that's just not enough.
Well, that's the issue, right? Is that you're just not getting enough out of South African bonds. And yes, they can price them certainly higher. They could certainly go up to 10 and 11 and 12%. You can buy bonds out there. But the question is, how much more does South Africa issue at those levels? You know, how and what happens with the yield curve down the line? And what does that look like? And I think this has got the South African Treasury, they must be scratching their heads around this and saying, well, how do we finance this? How do we fund this? Because the tax base continues to dwindle in South Africa whilst all of this is busy playing itself out. Look, I think the bond space in the US in 2 years from now is going to be a very different place. I think you would have unanimously have seen yields drop lower. And that is just because I think for the US government to fund the amount of debt that they have outstanding at these levels where rates are at the moment is going to become quite difficult. They can't fund that. They need to get the number lower than where GDP, long-term GDP growth is. Or alternatively, they've got to lift the GDP growth. And artificial intelligence and tech companies aren't necessarily going to do that. You need to create a whole new economy. And I suppose that's what brings us now to this Israeli conflict that's busy playing itself out. We saw the Ukrainian and the Russian conflict playing out a little bit earlier this year. We're now seeing this Israeli conflict playing itself out. And perhaps the new normal going forward for the next short to midterm future is a world that is just kind of not happy with each other. You've got parties trying to go to war with each other. That takes firepower. And firepower is a defense mechanism. Who's the biggest developer and influencer in a defense business? Governments. Who spends the most money? The government. And that becomes a growth driver, again, for economies. Might see some of that actually happening.
That's a very interesting take on it, I think, Kobe. You know, I think Biden has already committed to increase his aid to Israel. I doubt he will get much backlash from the Republicans, who are also, I think all Americans are pro-Israeli, whereas they may be not all pro-Ukrainian at this point in time. But that just means extra debt, doesn't it? It's a quandary. And I think from a South African point of view, it's going to be interesting to see what response Cyril gives. I'm hoping he's still asleep and he says nothing, right? I think that would be the best outcome, because every time he opens his mouth on a global stage, he seems to enjoy the taste of shoe leather. Let's put it that way. He just, you know, changes feet. That brings us, you know, onto one of the other topics, sort of South Africa related, is grey listing. This inertia, the government, the ANC inertia on grey listing is going to come back and hurt us. And it feeds into bond rates and perceptions of risk and all of these other things we've been talking about.
And I mean, it's interesting because you write about it, Dorian. You're saying, you know, since the grey listing event has happened, there's been precious little information from the government about what they're actually doing to combat this. And look, I've got no doubt they fires on at every turn. But the grey listing thing is a critically important thing for international finance in South Africa. Perhaps right in the beginning, large financial institutions might have said, look, South Africa will get it sorted. Let's not worry about it. We'll continue to put money into the banking system. We'll buy their bonds. We'll continue. But that cutoff date of January and February 2025 is a critical time. If we do not make that deadline, the Financial Action Task Force will take us from grey listing to blacklisting. If we go blacklisted, we are no better than some pariah states across the world, and our financial situation is going to become a lot more difficult. And I'll just give you a classic example of this, Dawn. So, you know, if we place money overseas for clients, sometimes some of our clients would work in the international space, and sometimes they might find themselves in a territory which is actually blacklisted. Why? Well, because these territories are generally war-torn and ravaged, and they work in those territories in order to try and rebuild it. But that means they get paid in those territories. You cannot shift your money out of that territory for love of money. Excuse the pun. It's very, very, very difficult. You try and give it to the Swiss, they're not going to take your capital. And that's just because the country has been blacklisted and they won't have a link with that country at all. So it is very important for us to not move from the grey listed world into the blacklisted world. It's very, very important for us to be able to move from the grey listed world back into a normal space where we're operating within the world community and the world environment, and we continue to be able to trade.
You know, the article that actually sort of prompted this insight came from the new CEO of FNB. And that got me very concerned, because if the Treasury were really serious about getting us off the grey list, they should have involved all the banks from day one, seconded all sorts of expertise from banking level, because that is where most of the regulation has to come right. Is at a banking level to actually help them get it right. And for the new CEO of FNB to say nothing's happening, nothing's happening.
So you're speaking now of FirstRand Group. This current CEO is a guy by the name of Alan Pullinger. He's a brilliant CEO. I've actually interviewed him for some radio shows. Absolutely, absolutely brilliant at his job, but he's obviously retiring. The chief operating officer, who's now Mary Vilakazi, is going to be taking over as the CEO of FirstRand, which is now obviously the holding group structure. Now, Dawn, it's critical what she's saying and what you're saying here today. There should be a lot more effort going into ensuring that we continue to shake hands with the international community. And we cannot do so if we do not keep to the rules and regulations that have been set up by independent bodies, such as the Financial Action Task Force, because it'll make life a lot more difficult, especially for people trying to move money across borders, trying to ensure that their capital is safe in banks, et cetera, et cetera. It'll just change that whole environment. And I suppose the other thing, and Dawn, you wrote about it quite extensively, I think, towards the beginning of the year, and that is to try and move yourself from blacklisting back again to not being blacklisted. Whatever that term might be, is a monumental effort. It is incredibly, incredibly difficult.
Yes, I mean, there's this window of opportunity. And the really sad thing is that this was not a surprise. The government had ample opportunity to stop us getting grey listed in the first place, but they chose to ignore all the efforts that were made by the Financial Action Task Force to say to them, listen, if you don't fix this, we're going to grey list you, we're going to grey list you, we're going to grey list you. Okay, not listening. Right, here you are. Here's your grey listing certificate. And look, the French are known for their sense of humor at the best of times. And this is, you know, the Financial Action Task Force is based in France.
I suppose in closing, let's speak about Israel. Israel obviously has now invaded Palestine. There's a war that's busy going on there because of the invasion from the Palestinians into Israeli territory. That is going to be interesting to watch. A lot of commentators are saying this looks like another take on the Yom Kippur War, which was 1973. This morning, I had news reports that Hezbollah was also trying to infiltrate and shooting missiles across from Lebanon into Israeli territory, and they've put a stop to that. I'm talking about the Israelis now. So this will be quite interesting to watch, Dawn, because obviously that's the Middle East. It's an oil area. And what does it mean from a geopolitical perspective, and how does these things shake out? And then specifically for South Africa, and I think you put it very aptly when you say, let's hope the government just keeps their mouth shut rather than trying to take sides in something like this. It's going to be a full-scale contact between Israel and the Palestinians for sure.
I think one of the most worrisome things is the Israeli Mossad specifically is considered to be the best intelligence force in the world. Why did it catch them by surprise? I think this is the big question that everybody is asking, is why did it catch them by surprise? And the speed at which they have escalated it, you know, they started off by, you know, shooting rockets up into sort of more northern Israel, and then they breached probably the most, one of the most stringent border posts, you know, that whole Gaza Strip is tiny. The Gaza Strip is in a minuscule little part of Israel. It does have the advantage of being on the coast, so they're not landlocked, which, you know, puts a whole additional problem on it. But that border is patrolled constantly, it's surveilled constantly by the Israelis. And yet it was breached in 27 places. People have been kidnapped as we're doing this, over 450 Israelis dead, God knows how many Palestinians. This is fast becoming a very nasty war. It's not just another skirmish that we're used to
No,
seeing out of Israel, and it's worrying from a geopolitical perspective.
This morning, I listened to a talk by Israeli Defense Force spokesperson, and they asked them exactly the same question. How come your intelligence failed, or how come your intelligence didn't know about this? And his answer quite simply was, we are going to be answering this question, but for now, we have a war to wage, and we're going to be doing that before we answer that question. But that is a critical question that we need to answer, and we don't have an answer yet, which I thought was quite a professional way to put it. And then obviously one of the accounts that I saw on the BBC today was a harrowing account by one of the concert goers who had to endure 3 hours of fighting with Hamas militants running around this place shooting people, and how she was fighting for her life, just trying to stay alive. And that is absolutely harrowing. I mean, it's literally a war zone, you know? 3 hours they went through something like this. So it's interesting times, Dawn. And look, let's see what happens with oil on Monday. The Americans have given them, meaning the Israelis, 100% support in this. And we'll see what transpires out of this whole thing. I don't think the Israelis are impressed. I don't believe that they're going to be taking this just slapping some people on the hand.
I think Netanyahu's days are numbered, frankly.
Yeah. No, look, that's obviously the other thing that's busy playing itself up. Thank you for joining us. This is week number 40. This is the podcast based upon our newsletter. Head over to our newsletter, read a lot more detail. There's a lot more information in there. And reach out and chat to us if there's anything that we've spoken about today that is perhaps close to your heart. Thank you for listening.